Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'm very pleased to be joined by Matthew Robinson today to talk about his new movie, Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die. It is directed by Gore Verbinski. It stars Sam Rockwell. There's a lot of interesting things going on here. We're in a kind of an interesting moment in Hollywood where you hear a lot about the difficulty of getting original stuff made. And this is a very original movie. This is in some ways almost a tribute to originality, a rejection of kind of everything that's going on in the world of AI and computers and everything else. But that also makes it hard to sell. That does make it hard to sell to people, because you can't just say, this is the new Spider-Man movie. This is the new, you know, Batman movie. You have to make the pitch to people. So I'm going to ask you, put you on the spot here. Can you give folks the elevator pitch for your new movie?
Absolutely. First of all, thanks for having me, Sonny. It's a pleasure to be here. But let me give you the quick, this is what I tell people what the movie's about. Homeless guy walks into a Norm's diner at 10 o'clock at night on a random Tuesday, says he's from the future. He's also strapped with bombs, and he's looking for a group of people who are going to help him save the world, and he has 2 hours to save the world. He's been here 117 times. He's tried thousands of combinations, but he is not going to give up till he finds the right combination of people and saves the world. Who's coming with me? And that's how the movie starts, and then it goes from there.
And that's a pretty succinct summary, certainly of the first 20 minutes or so of this movie, which just starts with this fantastic, not quite monologue, very close to monologue. There's a little bit of interaction, but it's just this wonderful monologue of Sam Rockwell delivering the problems with the future, really the problems with the present. And I have to imagine that sequence was a lot of fun to write.
It was great. Yeah, I mean, I really loved the idea of starting a movie with a 10. It was 10 pages, but it ended up being 12 minutes in the movie. But I always thought that was a really fun challenge. I love it. It actually came from a real experience of being in a Norm's diner and looking around and seeing everybody on their phones. This was like late at night. I was there just by myself with a book, having some coffee, probably taking a writing break, and every single person on their phones, and also me really struggling not to be on my phone to read a book and do something else, and wondering, like, what would it take for everyone in this place to recognize that we probably have a little bit of a problem that needs to be addressed? Is there a scenario where somebody could walk into this diner right now and get us all to change our behavior and potentially save the world? And then it would also be really funny if there was the homeless guy who was sleeping outside the Norm's as I walked in, who came in. Is there a scenario where we could believe him, that he's from the future, that he's seen where we end up? And could we all follow him out of this diner and go change the world? And that was really how it started. And it literally was just me sitting there in a Norm's diner wondering, how the hell do we all get off of these phones?
I have that experience anytime I'm out in public.
100%. Absolutely.
I have that experience anytime I'm out in public. When I'm at a restaurant and I see tables with, you know, five different people on five different devices, you know, kids looking at, you know, iPads or whatever, or on a bus. Yeah, bus a little bit different because everybody kind of wants to be, you kind of want to be in your own world in public transit.
Especially
but I get
Los
that.
Angeles.
But it really is a problem. What do these little cocoons do to us as a society? How is the atomization really affecting, you know, what you see in the world?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a Gen Xer, so and this movie is very much written from the perspective of a Gen Xer, and I think what makes that generation interesting is that I spent 20 years of my life without phones, and I've now spent 25 years of my life with phones. I really feel, and this movie was written right at that halfway point. You know, I wrote it almost 10 years ago. I remember very clearly all of high school, all of college, without phones, without social media, without the internet. And then I also remember every moment of the transition to the point we're in now, where the thought of leaving my house without my phone is terrifying and wild. And so this was really written from the perspective of, like, not shaming young people or anybody else for being on their phones, but more just trying to examine how did I went from both. And like, I will say it's a net negative. I do not think anything about my life is better with these phones. And yet it's right here. It's less than 6 inches away from my face at all times. It's turned off right now. But you know, it was more like examining, how did I get here? And why am I okay with this? Like, I have children. I don't blame my children for loving screens. They didn't grow up without it, but I know how much better it was. And yet that's how insidious these devices are and how somebody born without them is still just as susceptible to the addiction as anybody else.
Yeah, it's fascinating to hear you say that, because I'm just a couple years younger than you, so I remember this transition very well as well. I mean, I, you know, the going to college and Facebook kind of coming out my senior year of college, yeah. and being like, oh, this is different. This is
you were the like prime demographic.
Things are about to get weird, I think, and sure enough. And then, of course, the introduction of the iPhone and the iPad and everything else as we've gone along. And it does feel like it has radically altered not just how we access information, not just how we interact with the world, but really how we do interact with each other. And this is one of the great things about the opening sequence of this film is you have Sam Rockwell, who's just delivering this powerhouse monologue, kind of jumping from table to table, throwing phones and pitchers and being like, hey, am I not engaging enough for you? Am I not keeping your attention? It's wonderful. I don't have a question here. I just want to say thank you for writing it.
And it was so, I mean, like, it took us, I think, a week and a half to film it. I mean, it was a long sequence, and it was always like we did it. It was the first thing we shot, because if we don't get that right, there's no point in continuing the rest of the shoot. So like, it was like, let's nail this. Let's give it a lot of time. We built an entire Norm's Diner set on a soundstage in Cape Town, South Africa, which will unfortunately show you how impossible it is to make movies in Los Angeles at the moment, due to, you know, awful tax incentives and just how expensive everything is. But, you know, just standing in this Norm set for 10 days as we film this, and Sam, who, you know, has, I'm not speaking out of turn here, has said many times he does not like monologues. And I think he really took this on. I mean, it's funny because in the last year, he's become the monologue guy after this in White Lotus, especially after White Lotus. Yeah. But, you know, I think this was like, he was really like, I want to challenge myself with an insane monologue that, you know, is almost like has multiple structures to it. It totally could work as a short film. In fact, when I finished writing it, I was always like, this could just be a great little YouTube video, you know, and like just work as a lovely little small Twilight Zone episode.
I want to get to the making of this, because, you know, saying you first wrote this 10 years ago just should, that's a little tease here to get a sense of how long it takes to get things made in Hollywood or in Cape Town. But the opening shot of this film is just such a really nice visual touch. And I'm curious if it was in the script or if this was something that Verbinski came up with, but it's just a shot down a Norm's sign. Just Norm's. Mm-hmm. And then we go into this restaurant where we see everybody violating the most basic social norm of all, not paying attention. Like, it feels like Norm's. These are our Norm's now, staring into the phone. It just is such a nice little visual touch.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. And that is the real Norm's on La Cienega, which is where it takes place. Yeah, it's you know, I mean, that's all Gore. Gore is a genius at taking words on a page and creating dozens of, if not hundreds of small visual gags or little things that are going to be important later on. He layers it so deeply. I mean, anybody who loves his movies knows the more you watch them, the more you see things that you never realized were there. I mean, everything is so deeply layered. I mean, I would just write a simple transition scene between two different scenes and he would turn it into a set piece. You know, I mean, like, that's just how his brain works, and he's absolutely brilliant with that. So, yeah, I encourage people, you know, this is a wonderful movie to watch multiple times, purely just to see all the amazing little tiny details that Gore puts in, and they all pay off throughout the movie. He's so great with that.
It does look great. Look, I watch a lot of movies, I watch a lot of TV shows, and, you know, there's a certain amount of Netflix creep, a lot of kind of flat imagery and not really actually that interested in the visual aspect of the thing. You've got to say everything five times for it to, you know, come through, etc. And it's a pleasant reminder of how nice it is to watch like a really visual person work.
Yeah.
So you start writing this 10 years ago. Tell me about the process here, because again, this is, you know, there's a version of this that you shoot for YouTube that you make yourself and you put on YouTube. What was the whole process like?
Yeah, well, it's funny. This one was the strangest writing process I've ever had, in that it really came together almost like, you know, an airplane being built out of a hurricane. It started as, you know, there's multiple storylines. You could almost consider it an anthology movie, in the sense of a bunch of small stories all coming together into one large story. And that's how it was written. So one of the storylines is Mark and Janet, Michael Pena and Zazie Beetz, and they're teachers at a school, and there's something insidious going on. The students are doing something to the teachers that has something to do with their phones, and there's a mystery to be solved there. And that actually started as a pilot that I was working on. I had this vision of doing sort of Breakfast Club, where the teachers are the rebellious, confused, characters, and the students are, you know, monotonous villains. And just flipping that on its head and doing Breakfast Club from the teacher's perspective as the sort of more interesting characters. And then, I just felt like I never really had more than 20 pages there that I liked. And then I also had this story about school shootings, which was quite a difficult thing to figure out how to write and try to do a comedy about school shootings, or at least something that was able to take the absolute terror and nightmare of, you know, America and how we handle school shootings and turning it into something farcical. And I had a bunch of little small ideas. And then, like I said, I was at that Norms at that time, and I imagined this guy walking in and trying to get everybody's attention. And I realized I just had all these ideas about technology and how it was invading our lives these days. And then I thought, let's just try to write a great anthology movie about it. And then I was like, nobody wants anthology movies, so let's hide the fact that it's an anthology movie by giving one long overarching story that would be The Man from the Future, you know, taking everybody on this quest. And find a way to sort of like Pulp Fiction is in essence an anthology movie, but you don't feel it that way because the narrative all weaves together in a really lovely way. So that was my goal, was just to take all these little smaller ideas that didn't deserve a movie unto their own and to try to bridge them all together into some sort of thesis about how awful technology has been recently.
The section on school shootings that you just mentioned here is interesting because I don't want to spoil anything here, but it kind of creates the scenario where kids are, I'll just say, reprogrammed, and
sure.
the kind of platitudes that they spout and the way that the company has worked advertising into their brains is fascinating, and also just like the sort of thing that does not feel, that almost feels too close to home to work as satire. It just feels so real sometimes.
I know. That's funny. It came from I remember buying a Kindle and then just like trying to just read like some great novel on it. And, you know, I turn it on and there's just like an advertisement for like some awful stuff on my Kindle screen. And I was just like, how did we get to the point where I can't even open a book to read without getting like some random insane advertisement that I have no interest in seeing? And so, yeah, that taken to 11 is, you know, your child who died in a school shooting coming back to life and giving you ads as the your sort of payment for having your child again.
Yes, the idea of trying to sit down to read, you know, the Brothers Karamazov and getting the latest
romantic.
That's
funny. They found a lot of ways to advertise to us.
Yeah, the social commentary is there, obviously, but it is more than that. It's a you know, kind of action movie. It is a comedy, and it's just got these great performances in it. When you were sitting down to when this movie was being cast, I mean, who were you always like Sam Rockwell? He's our guy. Like, how did he come on board?
Yeah, so you know, so often when you're writing a movie, you have the archetype in your head, you know, and you never think you're actually going to ever get that person. It's just always like, this is a Sam Rockwell type. And that is exactly what happened with Good Luck, was that I was always pitching it. People would say, like, who do you have in mind? I'd be like, it's a Sam Rockwell type, you know, and then eventually it was just like Gore got involved, and Gore has a lot of clout and people want to work with Gore. And we were both just like, it's a Sam Rockwell type. And it's like, it should be Sam Rockwell, not a Sam Rockwell type. And luckily, Sam really responded to the material. But it was always going to be a bombastic, loud, you know, really loose actor that can do that can sort of, and Sam's famous for dancing on screen, that can sort of tap dance through a scene, you know, in a really entertaining but real and grounded way, which is something Sam does so well. Is he's able to be really funny, he's able to be really vulnerable, he's able to be really real, and he's able to also give you a wonderful popcorn movie scene, you know, which is that's a lot of balls to juggle, and there's only a handful of actors in the world that can do it. And also, like, to an extent, there was only like a handful of humans in the world that actually, I think, could pull this monologue off, and Sam was at the top of that list.
It's a pretty fantastic cast all around. I mean, Juno Temple was great in this. Michael Peña's Zazie Beetz.
Dream cast. It was just a wild collection of brilliant people.
And just the struggle to get them all on set at the same time. Whenever I look at a movie like this, I just think logistics.
Yeah. And then imagine doing it in Cape Town.
Yeah.
That's a long flight from the rest of where most people in the film live.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about getting Gore Verbinski involved? Because, you know, I think people will be most familiar with the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. Those were enormous hits. Billion dollar grocers, you know, it just huge, huge hits. I've loved him since The Ring. I prefer it to the original. It has this great visual look. It is this kind of perfect Seattle, Pacific Northwest movie, where it is set. But he has such a great visual eye, and certainly, you know, between this and his last movie, which came out, boy, it's been 8 years now since
8 years since Cure for Wellness. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It feels like he's got a lot of thoughts about what's going on in the world. Like this, what drew him to this project?
Yeah, I mean, look, Gore is an artist. Like Gore is an artist working within the Hollywood system, which I think is maybe the hardest thing for an artist to pull off without losing their integrity, without losing their voice and their soul. And he makes incredible, huge popcorn movies that are also deep and profound and human and moving. And that to me is, you know, the great trick to pull off, to figure out how to tell a great movie within the system to a massive audience. You know, that's what Dickens did. You know, that's what so many of the great writers and authors and filmmakers have figured out how to do. And that's always to me the great magic trick. And Gore, I think, we had similar intentions. I wanted to make a movie that's about something, but I really wanted to make a great sci-fi popcorn movie. Those are my memories of sitting in the theater and watching Terminator 2, of watching 12 Monkeys, you know, of seeing just these incredible, beautiful, original, mind-blowing science fiction movies, and wanting to add to that chain, you know, wanting to be involved in that. And Gore, I think, saw this as an opportunity to do something at a reasonable budget, but that felt grand. That still was a popcorn movie. And we always talked about that. You know, we wanted to make an entertaining movie for everyone that happened to also be about something that felt important to us. And that's a small needle to thread. And we used to get those movies twice a week back in the 90s and 2000s. You know, we had no idea sort of how lucky we were. And now it's pretty rare that you get to go and see a movie that you have no idea what to expect.
I'll say, yeah, I it's funny. I mentioned this last week when Send Help came out. Send Help, is the
wonderful
new
movie.
Sam Raimi film. You know, he hasn't made. I guess there was the Doctor Strange movie, but you know, it's been a few years since he had a new original
since Drag
sort of
Me
thing
to Hell,
out.
Yeah.
And that you know, again, high concept, genre adjacent sort of movie that, like you said, we used to get, I don't know, every studio used to make five or six of these a year, and they would fill in the gaps in the schedule. And we don't really get those anymore. And that is, like, if I were going to pitch this to you, the listener, and you should go see this, it's going to be playing in theaters, what's the release date? February 13th. February 13th. Great Valentine's Day movie.
Great double feature with Wuthering Heights, you know? I mean, like I would see Wuthering Heights first, and I would end your night with Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die. I think that would be because that'll wake you up, and you know, maybe you shed a few tears in Wuthering Heights, and then you want to end with a big laugh. I think it's a great double feature.
Great double feature. People should definitely check it out. But this is, again, this is the sort of movie we used to get all the time, and we don't get them anymore. And I'm just curious, you know, as a writer, from your perspective, what have we lost? What have we lost by losing that kind of window into original genre programmer entertainment?
Yeah, well, you know, we've lost the mid-budget film. That's, you know, and what was special about the mid-budget film was that the studio wasn't so terrified about losing their shirts on the movie. And so they were willing to hand it over to an artist, to a voice, to a perspective that wasn't necessarily needing to be a massive tentpole for them, didn't need to become a franchise, and was something, in a lot of ways, was goodwill that they were doing for the directors. They want to keep those people happy. They're hoping one day they'll make a big tentpole for them. But in the meantime, you know, let's do a nice little $30 million movie. Maybe it makes 35. We're happy with that. If it makes 25, no big deal. You know, hopefully it doesn't lose everything. Obviously, nobody makes a movie they think is going to lose money. But, you know, it was a space where you could take some risks, try some new things, pull in an audience you wouldn't normally get, and also ingratiate yourself with a great filmmaker and, you know, maybe one day convince them to, you know, like Gore, make Pirates, you know, and they find a way to turn that small independent voice into something that can speak to the masses as well. So, you know, it was good for everybody. It was good for the studios. It was good for audiences. And, you know, I mean, the economy changes, people's viewing habits change, and it makes sense that we get to the point where we're only getting, you know, very small $3 million, $4 million horror movies and then $300-400 million Marvel movies.
Yeah. Yeah. The rise of the, you know, $40 million ad campaign doesn't help either. It's so expensive to market.
Well, that's all. Yeah. There's no such thing as a $30 million movie anymore because you're going to spend more than that just marketing it.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
So you write this thing, and then it has to be a real odyssey, you know, just working through the various studios, trying to get it made. Can you just like give people a sense of what it's like to, you know, bang your head against the wall for 8 years to get a movie like this made?
Yeah. Well, look, this wasn't my first script. So luckily I was already established. I had already made a bunch of movies. I'd already been working in the studio system for a long time. So I was able to get it to a lot of very friendly producers, a lot of very friendly directors. And quickly it was a script that just got around town. And it was one of those scripts, I've written a few of them in my life before, where it's like a calling card. People pass it around. Look at how fun this is. This guy's got a great voice. This movie's really entertaining. Obviously, no one's ever going to make this crazy movie, but don't you think he would be great at XYZ? And so, like, you know, even without Good Luck Having Fun getting made, I booked a lot of jobs off of it. I mean, Doug Liman read it and hired me to do a draft of Edge of Tomorrow 2. Mm-hmm. You know, I was writing a Star Wars movie off of it. Like, literally, like, that's my recommendation to writers, is write the movie you dream of making that may never get made. And then at worst case scenario, I mean, well, not worst case scenario, is nobody ever reads it. But even if the movie never gets made, it becomes a lovely calling card for you. And people then, you know, see what you're capable of doing and maybe think that it can apply to some other properties as well or some other movies. And then it's a miracle if it ever gets made. And, you know, it didn't look like it was going to get made for a long time. There was many people attached to it, many studios, but everybody always got scared about the same thing, which was the school shooting stuff, you know? And they would always say, this is all well and good, but what happens if there's a major school shooting the weekend the movie comes out? We're in trouble then. And you would go, well, we're in America, there will be, you know, like that's what the movie's about. Like we need to face that. Like it's a nightmare. I agree. I'm trying to, you know, look at it. But you know, I get it. Nobody wants to, you know, lose all their money.
Nobody wants to lose all their money. And that is, you know, look, that is a constant kind of threat specter looming over everything. But, you know, the other real threat and specter looming over everything is the the consumption of the entertainment industrial complex by the world of AI, right? Which mm-hmm. is absolutely a thing that is happening in the world of filmmaking, in the world of the world of entertainment, the world of media. Let me, I just want to read, you know, I'm sorry to do this. This isn't a media podcast, but there was just a ridiculous line in the editor of the Washington Post's mm-hmm. kind of farewell letter to all the people who got laid off today. Let's see. I'm sorry, give me one sec. All right. Platforms like search that shaped the previous era of digital news and which once helped the Post thrive are in serious decline. Our organic search has fallen by nearly half in the last 3 years. And we are still in the early days of AI generated content, which is drastically reshaping user experiences and expectations. And I got to say, as a reader of The Washington Post, I look at that and I just think, why would I bother? Yeah. Why would I bother reading AI generated material? Why would I want to watch AI generated videos at the Washington Post? I can watch somebody do that on YouTube for nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I'm the only person in the world that hasn't even used ChatGPT at this point. And it's not because I'm, you know, trying to hold some moral high ground. I just haven't found a reason. Google works fine for me. I've never not found something I'm looking for. I recognize now that even when you Google something, the first thing that comes up is AI sort of giving you your, you know, what it thinks the answer is. It's weird to me how quickly people found a use for it. I've yet to find something that's interesting to me about it. I don't know. Yeah. I can't imagine ever on purpose looking for content made by AI. I felt that same way about phones 20 years ago. I remember walking on the streets of New York in like 1998 and seeing the first people on their large Nokia phones. And I remember saying to my friend, like, that's never going to be me. Like, those people I felt pity for them. I was just like, who wants to always be connected? Like, my whole point was I was 18. I was walking around the streets of New York with my friends. I don't want somebody to find me. I don't want somebody to be able to call me and interrupt my day. And that sounded insane to me. So I don't know. Maybe in 20 years, I'll also, you know, be looking back at myself as, you know, somebody who thought they were going to avoid AI and couldn't.
As best as I can tell, nobody's going to be able to avoid it. That's the real
sure.
takeaway from life. The structure of this film is very interesting because it is almost structured like a video game. There are Ooh. Video game kind of elements to it. I was very interested to hear you say that this script got you a job on Edge of Tomorrow 2. The first one, of course, is very much a video game. That movie is like the best video game movie ever made. It's not even based on a video game. But the video game elements of it are another thing that, again, like, I feel like everyone, or lots of people thought, like, oh, video games, what are video games? We can't, that's nothing. And I do think there is something artistically useful and profound to be found in video games that does kind of get worked into the script. Were you thinking about gaming culture as you were writing this?
100%, yes. The only thing I love more than movies are games, board games, video games. I have a game brain. I love games. And the title itself came from my experiences playing MOBAs. I was playing Dota 2. I was playing League of Legends. And if you remember playing those games 10 years ago, that was what people said to each other at the beginning of a match. You'd say, good luck, have fun, don't die. And you were saying don't die because you were feeding the other team. Every time you would die, the other team would get stronger. And so that was the wish to people. You would say, please just don't die. But, you know, good luck, have some fun too. And I always thought that was a really wonderful. I always thought it was a sort of a beautiful way to say hi. We'd all just say GLHFDD at the beginning of a match. And that to me was like, that's such a wonderful modern, like the character Tim says in the movie, like, you know, it's kind of like aloha, you know, we say it at the beginning, we say it at the end. And I just thought that was a lovely little bit of new communication that was being created in our time. And then, yeah, the movie in and itself is very much a video game. Anytime when you can die and start over, you're in video game territory. And then I just went nuts with that. I mean, you know, there's a princess in the movie that, you know, maybe needs to be saved at some point. And there are different obstacles and bosses that must be passed. And there are maps. And there, I mean, it's all video game language in there. That is very, and then Gore went nuts with that too. And I won't spoil anything, but people who want to find things in the background, you will find lovely allusions to 1,000 amazing video games.
Well, that's another sign that I need to rewatch. I watched it twice, and I was I was not looking specifically for video game references, but when I see it again, I will have to keep an eye out for those. So you're a gamer. You like games. That segment with Tim is interesting. So there's a character in the movie who gets kind of almost accidentally sucked into a virtual world, but that's a very negative thing. That's a very negative thing for him.
Is it? Yeah. I mean, it's negative for his girlfriend, but it's, I think, pretty positive for him. I don't think he's experiencing any downsides, much like, you know, the drug addict before it ruins their life is definitely, they're happier, you know, they're high, they're experiencing a different reality without pain or sadness or anything bad. And he's in a great place. It's everyone around him that is worried about him. I mean, you know, and that to me was a philosophical question that I always found interesting, because I also got really into virtual reality. I've owned dozens of different, I buy every VR gadget. I think it's a really fascinating world. And I really started wondering if somebody created a better reality, you know, a reality that was better in every possible way that you could not say was not better than our reality, and you could just live in it forever, what's the downside? You know, I mean, what really is the downside other than, you know, morally, you know, we have this idea that reality is intrinsically better than a fake reality. But it's the same questions they're asking in The Matrix. You know, it's, you know, Joey Pants, when he's eating the steak, you know, it tastes like steak. It's the best steak I've ever eaten in my life. Like, I don't care that it's not real. It's delicious. You know, and I mean, so I was just sort of going back to that question of like, who cares if it's fake? Is that what makes real better? And so, yeah, that was an interesting character to sort of play with and, you know, question those things of, I don't know, what makes just the fact that it's real better? I don't know. Is it?
God, it's interesting you say that, because in my notes, I definitely had, you know, this feels like people have chosen The Matrix. This is a movie from the perspective of the people who chose The Matrix.
They're not in goo pods. They're diving into the goo pods. They're saying, put me in there, please. Yeah, I mean, and we all are. I mean, that's, you know, we're all sort of choosing a world of endless entertainment, and it's hard to blame people for doing that.
You said you're into games, board games. What are your favorite board games? And I've got a lot of real board game friends. You know, get into the, you know, Catan and all that. What's your vice?
Yeah, well, board games are my life. I do love video games, but I have a board game podcast. I go to board game conventions. I'm showing you my full geek card here. But my favorite board game of all time is a 16th century German farm simulator called Agricola, designed by the brilliant Uwe Rosenberg. I highly recommend anybody who loves high strategy European style board games to check out the masterpiece Agricola. I did not expect to say on this podcast today.
That's the most board game person answer I think I've ever heard. Like I said, I've got a lot of good friends who are very into board games, and that is the most. I could not possibly have expected that or topped it. If I was writing your answer myself, it's very funny.
I also love games with giant dragon miniatures and rolling dice too. But you know, if I'm going to be pretentious, I'm going to say Agricola.
Well, it does feel like board games are having a moment too. I mean, there's the whole kind of Stranger Things RPG thing, but like and part of this I think was, you know, pandemic related, kind of, you know, people wanted to be in their pods and have things to do.
Yeah.
But it does feel like board games are like they have entered they are firmly in an experimental phase that I think will be alien to anybody whose last experience is like Scrabble and Monopoly.
Yeah. Well, it's my love for board games is very much, you know, a reaction to my desire to be off of electronics. It's It's the only time, I think, other than when I'm sleeping, when I don't think about looking at my phone. You know, I'm just so consumed. I'm in a world of cardboard and human beings at my table, my friends, people I love, sitting across from them. And your phone just disappears. You forget it exists because you're thinking about your turn. You're thinking about other people's turn. You're cracking jokes. You're maybe drinking a beer. You're having some snacks. You're socializing in a situation where there's no time to be to need distraction. And I feel like I'm always longing for those experiences. And so I highly recommend board games to people who feel like they look at screens too often. And, you know, I'm also a writer. And I don't have a typewriter, so I'm looking at my screen 8 hours a day. And so I don't want to look at a screen at night as well, even if I'm playing a video game I love. You know, I'd much rather like give my eyes a break and my brain a break and be around other people.
Yeah. All right. Let's get back to Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die. Again, it's in theaters February 13th. Yep. Folks should go see it. I'm an evangelist for new original things. This is very new, very original. But it does feel like it has reference points. You know, the Matrix we mentioned. Mm-hmm. Watching it and knowing that Gore Verbinski had directed it, the sequence where the kids are looking at their phone, like, mm-hmm. really called to mind The Ring to me. But instead, mm-hmm. of, you know, sending out a demon, it kind of pulls you in. It's kind, mm-hmm. of like a reverse Ring. What other reference points should, if people want to prepare themselves to go see this movie, what should they watch?
So Terry Gilliam is a huge reference point for this movie for me, and one of my favorite artists ever. Brazil and 12 Monkeys are huge influences on this. Akira is a huge influence on this. There's a science fiction short called La Jetée, which is what 12 Monkeys is based on. I highly recommend anybody find that. It's less than 10 minutes long. It's one of the greatest short films ever made. The first Terminator, huge influence on me. As much as I love T2, the first Terminator to me is the Bible. T2 is, the New Testament. But I love Terminator. It's a masterpiece to me. Pulp Fiction, of course, a huge influence just in terms of narrative structure. And in a lot of ways, the Chaucer novel Canterbury Tales was sort of where I got the idea of doing an ongoing story wherein you push in and get the origin stories of the people who are on the journey, which is just the story of Canterbury Tales. If you never read Canterbury Tales, I highly recommend you read that wonderful, wonderful book. Yeah, that structurally is where I took, you know, pretty much everything from. But yeah, go watch Brazil, go watch Akira, go watch the first Terminator. If you can find La Jetée somewhere, it's a lovely little short film, maybe the greatest short film ever made on time travel.
I think La Jetée was on, it was on the Criterion Channel for a while.
Yeah, it's been on and off that, yeah.
But
it's findable. Yeah. It's probably on YouTube.
It probably is. It probably is. Those are all great. I also big fan of Gilliam, and in particular Brazil and Time Bandits is more big my time. Jam than 12 Monkeys. But 12 Monkeys also great. This has been a great deal of fun for me. I watched the movie twice now. It's got a lot of little interesting hooks and tidbits, and I really recommend folks check it out. I always like to close these interviews by asking, there's anything I should have asked? If you think there's anything people should know about the movie, again, Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die. It's in theaters February 13th. Check it out. Or anything else in the world. What did we not discuss that we should have?
Yeah, I think I would just say, you know, we're definitely at a huge decision point in the film industry right now. And the only way to let the studios know that there is still value in original films is to show up at the theaters on opening weekends. We're also, I feel like this has been an incredible start to the year. I mean, The Bone Temple and Send Help are movies that almost shouldn't exist anymore. And that's how I feel about Good Luck, too. I mean, it's like, I do feel like we've gotten these two great original. I mean, obviously, The Bone Temple is, you know, a sequel to, you know, the 28 franchise, but it's a masterpiece, I think. And I'm genuinely don't say that lightly. I was blown away by how good The Bone Temple is. It's a beautiful bit of science fiction, horror, incredible movie that should not exist in this day and age. And Send Help also, I mean, Sam Raimi and the Coens, I think, are the two most important creators of my lifetime in the film world. And Send Help is just another gift from the master. Go see those movies. Show the studios that we care about original, smart genre pictures, popcorn movies that have something to say. And if you like those movies, I think you'll like Good Luck too. And, you know, we have to show the studios that we will see them in theaters. If we only show them, we're going to see them on Netflix or streaming. They're not going to make them anymore because there's not enough revenue in that. So if you want to see those movies, I know it's expensive. I know it sucks. I also have kids. A babysitter's expensive. It's a $100 night out at the movies. But, you know, if you can afford it, this is the only way we can show them that original movies matter.
Amen. Amen. Go see Good Luck. Have fun. Don't die in a theater. It's in theaters February 13th. Yep. Then come back in here and talk about it in the comments of this episode. Absolutely. I think you guys will enjoy it. It'll be fun. Matthew, thank you for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sonny. It was a really good time. I enjoyed talking with you.
And my name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.